prophets. I'm turning to the book of the prophet Habakkuk. And, we begin from chapter 1, Habakkuk, chapter 1. Let's begin with verses 1 and 2. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see, O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? Even cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. Well, a good title that for Habakkuk's book is that the just will live by faith, or the just lives by faith. Because the entire book, three chapters, you know, it follows our discussion of the short books in the Old Testament. The book is really about two complaints that Habakkuk had. And these complaints, he took them to the Lord, and the Lord answered them. And he responds with an attitude of worship and submission and praise and thanks. Habakkuk's book deals with the problem that has bedeviled people. Now, Christians have the answer doesn't remove all the difficulties, but it is a satisfactory one. It's a problem sometimes in the area of philosophy, they call it the problem of evil. Why do bad things happen to good people? That kind of question. And Habakkuk himself, what he did was to really put that question to God, sort of. And here, God gives Habakkuk the answers. As I said, the answers doesn't settle everything. But what is beautiful is that Habakkuk comes to know or demonstrates how to respond to God in these matters. So it's a very, very comforting book to just read through it. Initially, you may have some difficulties, but if you just take your time, and as you keep reading through, it becomes clearer and clearer. And it's such a, as I said, very comforting book. And it's worth reading. Remember, the last week we looked at Nahum, who was a prophet against Assyria. And we saw that he spoke against Assyria because of their wickedness. Now, we will soon see that Habakkuk would also be speaking against Babylon or the Chaldeans. And there will be a very interesting lesson for us to learn from there. It is suggested that Habakkuk may have prophesied in the days of Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim, I'm sure you know, is a brother. Yes, of Jehoahaz, some of the children of Josiah, the last godly king of Judah. Jehoiakim, in his times, was so much wickedness in the nation of Judah. You know, at this time, the northern tribe is gone to captivity, so it's left with the southern tribe alone. So any time around, it is suggested around 610 BC, because they invaded, the Chaldeans or the Babylonians invaded Judah at the time of Jehoiakim. It is around that time. Even though this cannot be absolutely settled, you know, dates are difficult, except where the prophet deliberately tells us, like one of the prophets will go to Zephaniah, he would tell us when these things occurred. I think so anyway. But this is Habakkuk. His name means embrace, or somebody who embraces the Lord, or even somebody who struggles. He struggles for his people, but he actually embraces the Lord. He embraces the Lord. It seems his name fits his own attitude. He embraces the Lord in spite of what was happening. Now, let us get into the book directly. Because it's a survey, you know, I'll not be addressing every single verse, but I'll try and mention what the chapter is about and then pick out some of those verses that highlight the theme in that chapter, as we did with Nahum and the others, because we cannot cover all the verses. So we're taking a swift reading through the book and try to appreciate some of the things. Chapters 1 and 2 is where the questions are. In chapters 1 and 2, you have Habakkuk's question and the answers God gives him. And then chapter 3 is this response of gratitude, praise, and submission, and trust. And so it's as simple as that. So the first two chapters are really the question and the answers which Habakkuk had to deal with before the Lord. And so in chapter 1, from verses 1 to 4, it is the problem of the wickedness in Judah. And Habakkuk is worried. Verse 2, O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear, even cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save? This is his worry. Why dost thou show me iniquity, and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up strife and contention. There are those who are promoters of evil. And Habakkuk sees them all the place in Judah. And he's worried. And he tells us he's been praying about that. I hope, my dear friends, we do the same thing for our nation and the wickedness that is really growing on every side. It should never, ever escape our minds. And so this is what Habakkuk was doing. And he was praying earnestly. And he goes to God with that reason. Why are you not answering me? And then look at how he puts it in verse 4. Very, very pointed indeed. Therefore, the law is lacked. The law here is the Torah. So the commandments of the Lord is lacked. Meaning nobody cares about that. What does the law say? Even the people of Judah don't care. Everybody snubs the law, and judgment doth never go forth. There's no fairness. No one treats the other right. If you went to the law courts, no one would be fair with you. And so the judgments never went forth. For wickedness doth compass, I beg your pardon, for the wicked doth compass about the righteous. Therefore, wrong judgment proceedeth. You see what he's saying? Wicked people have really overshadowed the righteous. The wicked people have swallowed up. Not because the righteous are no longer existent, but the wicked have so much outnumbered them, so that the righteous are simply insignificant. And so because the wicked are the ones who are dominating everything, it is their will and wishes that drives everything and controls everything. And for that sake, judgment is thrown away and the law slacks. And so this is the sin. And so Habakkuk in effect is saying, Oh Lord, what would you do about this? This is the case. And God answers him in from verses 5. to 11, and what is God's answer? It's here, verse 6. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. I am sending the Chaldeans to punish it, says God. This is my response to the wickedness. I'm sending a punishment. The Chaldeans are coming from the north, and they will come all over to take over the land, and they will simply humiliate the land and punish them because of their sins. So that's the first question and the answer. The first question is, Lord, why are you not punishing wickedness in Judah, in Judea or Judah? And God is saying, I am bringing punishment. I am bringing them from the Chaldeans. They will come and punish the land. And they would do with it. They would humiliate the land. And look at how he puts it here. Verse 8. Their horses also are swifter than the leopards, and are more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far. They shall fly as the eagle that hasteth to eat. Do you see? They will simply subdue the nation, run up and down every corner, and subdue every person. And so Habakkuk, be quiet and bring in punishment. But God adds something which is quite curious. Look at verse 10 and 11. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall be a scorn unto them. They will ridicule your kings because they will treat them as small boys. They won't be able to stand them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust and take it. This is not where the problem is. The problem is in verse 11. Listen to this. Then
shall his mind, that is the king of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar, then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing thus his power unto his God. He's simply saying that after he subdued the nation, he will simply walk over the nation and then go back to his country and worship his idols and adore his idols, praising his conquests, attributing the victory to his idols. Why is God saying this? He's reminding them this is going to be a humiliation from the hand of the Lord. So that instead of you having the victory and glorifying your God, I will allow him to subdue my land, even though he will glorify his idols. It's a mysterious thing about God's dealings. Isn't that sometimes surprising? And it will bring up the next question that Habakkuk will raise very, very emotionally in the next few verses. God is aware that the Babylonians, when they subdue Judah, they will attribute their conquest to the idols. So why did God give them the victory? You see how God's ways are mysterious? He sees some worldly persons. Now, if God allows their purposes to go through and he passes the exam and he gets that job, he will go back and perhaps praise something else rather than Almighty God. Why does God still give him that? Why does God simply say, hey, I see you. If I let you pass your exam, I think the next time is that you go to that shrine there and pour libations. I'm not going to give that to you. No, God doesn't. And that's part of the question. It's almost as if in answering Habakkuk, God actually highlights the problem even more. Because it brings another part of the problem in the world we all grapple with. Why does God even bless those who at the end of it actually glorifies something else rather than him? Why does he do that? He doesn't give Habakkuk all the answer, but he points to him how he should reason and how we should see things. You see, and so this is quite sad. In fact, he will raise this up again, and then I will touch on something else when we come to that. So Habakkuk raises a question, and you can see his emotions in verse 12. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, mine Holy One? We shall not die. We are your people. We cannot really entirely be removed and destroyed by the Chaldeans. O Lord, thou hast ordained them that the Chaldeans for judgment. And Almighty God, thou hast established them for correction. You are going to use them to correct us. And this is where my problem lies, says Habakkuk. Verse 13. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than he? You see what he's saying? Oh Lord, actually, I said that the people of Judah are very terrible. But oh Lord, as for this one, if we were to do some comparison, the people of Judah are far better than the Chaldeans. So why are you using the Chaldeans to punish people who are better than them? You see the problem? Why does God sometimes use unbelieving hands to punish his own children? Well, we are very worse. By the grace of God, we are better than unbelievers, even in a very worse state, because of the grace of God in us and his Spirit in us. And yet he's able to use the arm of the world to chastise us. And Habakkuk is asking, oh Lord, why? Why do you do that? why are you going to do this? And he uses a very powerful imagery. For it's here in verses 14 and 15. Look at it here. And make us men as the fishes of the sea, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them. Lord, you are making things look like the animal farm, where it's the stronger animal who simply subdues the weaker animal. All of us have become, therefore, like fish in the sea. Nebuchadnezzar is the fisherman, and he holds his angle or his net. He mentions the net there in verse 15. They take up all of them with the angle, their hook, and catch them in their net, and gather them in their drag, as a drag net. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. You have yielded the nations to this wicked king, who is actually treating all of us like fish. He simply comes up anytime he chooses, and he throws in his angle, or he throws in his net, and he simply drags a fish away. This doesn't seem righteous. And so he said that, God, you are of pure eyes. You cannot look on evil. This is an evil person punishing somebody far better than himself. How can you look on, oh Almighty God? And so he brings the question to the Lord. And look at what the Lord said in verse 11. Habakkuk picks it up, even in a way that is even more disturbing. Verse 16. Therefore, that's after he had done, dragged the fish and all that. Therefore, they sacrifice unto their net and burn incense unto their drug, because by them, that's by the net and the drug, their portion is fat and their meat plenteous. After they've dragged the net, what do fishermen do? Do you know the fishermen? Have you been to the fishing shores? No, some of them, some of them really have a little shrines even on their net, where the ropes are. They've tied up these little shrines. There's something's head or something, an egg or something tied into something. It's there. And so when they get all this fish, what do? They bow their heads and say, that idol, that God gave us all this catch. And Habakkuk is saying, Lord, after Nebuchadnezzar has done all this, you've allowed him to do that. He praises his own skill. He praises his own stratagem in battle. He goes back and becomes bloated and says, look at me. My strategies worked in Judah, and I subdued them. I sent in my army, and I sent them around that corner, and they simply overwhelmed the person. He was simply brag over his own net, the skills that he could use to achieve all that. As Habakkuk is simply saying, why would you, number one, let a wicked nation punish a nation better than themselves, when, oh Lord, you know that after they had done that, they glorify themselves and they glorify their own idols. Why do you do that? Now, chapter 2 is God's answer to Habakkuk. Now, what God does first is say, in effect, tell Habakkuk, well, prepare yourself for the answer. Because the answer is wonderful by all means, but at the same time, it doesn't satisfy all the curiosity. And so Habakkuk prepares himself as one. I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will watch to see what he will say unto me and what I shall answer when I am reproved. When I am reproved means when I am questioned. When people question me, there may be some righteous persons in Judah who will also question me. I'm waiting for my answer. I'm waiting on this tower. I'm waiting until God gives me an answer, so that when the other righteous persons ask me, I know what to tell them. And then the answer comes. And this first answer is not really clearing the problem, but to tell him he has to wait in faith. Verse 2. And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it. In other words, when you receive the vision, write it there. Because the answer has to be kept as a kind of a permanent message. It should not be a transient thing that you will read in a few persons and it's finished. This is a permanent thing. And so, write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it. Write it so plainly, so that anyone at all can. It's so plain that even as you run, you can be reading. You don't have to stop to read it. In other words, it should be so clear that everyone can understand and appreciate. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Behold, his soul shall be lifted up. Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. What a very instructive verse. Let me read that to you. So, slowly. Behold, a soul which is lifted up in him. I beg your pardon, I'm not reading properly. Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him, but the just shall live by faith. I know that you know that the latter part is what the Apostle Paul quotes in Romans chapter 1, verse 17. The just shall live by faith. The motto of the Reformation when the Lord brought the influence of Roman Catholicism down. But what is the verse saying? It is this. Now, the person who is a proud person because he's a lifted up person is not upright. It's not, why is he not upright? Because if somebody is proud, he will not wait for my answer. He will not wait for what I say about the issue. He will draw up his own conclusions and act upon them. And what his actions will be, will by all means be an action that is not upright. Friend, this is a very important lesson. Here is a question, and it's almost like the Lord is commending Habakkuk. Habakkuk is saying this, Lord, I don't understand. I'm waiting on you to teach me and to grant me insight. And God is saying, this is right, Habakkuk. A person who has faith will behave this way. He would only wait for answers from the Lord. Why? Because he tells himself, only God knows the answers. Only God has all the facts. Only God is infinitely wise. And so I will wait for the Lord to give me answer. But if somebody is a proud person, lifted up, if somebody is a proud person, he will not be upright in the sense that he will want to go his own way, draw up his own conclusions, and follow after that. And by all means, if the conclusions I draw from the issues of life are not consistent with the mind of God, how can the action I take be consistent with the mind of God? Evidently, I will sin against the Lord. And so, it shows us a very, very fundamental attitude of Christians. My dear friends, it is a kind of answer people don't want today. When you have to sometimes tell people, that well, we do not understand why God may have permitted such a trouble upon you. Like Job's case, you know. You know, Job did a similar thing. In fact, Job was speaking so right until his friends came. The three friends didn't help him at all. Because their mentality about life was wrong. They held that wrong mentality, in fact, very common with the charismatics now, that said, if you are righteous, everything will be all right with you. And that is only when you are wicked that things become so bad. As in effect, they were telling Job, probably, you remember, I'm not telling you that, but you know, there were times they told him, Job, examine yourself. By implication, they meant, you know, probably because you are sinned. This miserable condition you are in, most likely you've committed some sin. All along that you seem to be a very godly man, probably you committed some secret sins. And then they compel Job sometimes to say, I wish that God was here and I will lay my argument before him because I don't understand. It is because of what the friends were saying. And sometimes, you know, we have, some time ago, there was a man and his wife who was visiting our church. They were never members, and we really didn't think they were Christians. And so we understood why. The man had a very strange illness. It came at certain times, and he would virtually not be able to walk. He would have to bear pain throughout the night. It's like he could not put any part of his body even on the bed. He has to really suspend the whole body on his elbows on the bed throughout the night. It's a very uncomfortable situation. And when you're dealing with people like that, you know the emotions involved. And the family members have come around to tell him they've brought in prophets. And these days, when people are going through that, it is so painful because of all kinds of people that will be brought in. They brought in a prophet that said that, oh, they want to ruin his life from because of where he's teaching and all that. And the man has been able to connect how that any time he was about to go for interview for promotion is the time that the illness comes. See, he was able to draw all those kind of connections. And of course, I knew he didn't really. It was hard for him to trust the Lord. So I was trying to point out to him that while we cannot understand all of God's ways, but one thing we should never do, and that's what the Lord is almost commending Habakkuk here. Once you tell yourself, I do not understand why, but I will never choose an unscriptural solution. I will never choose a solution that God does not approve. I may not understand why, and the situation may be painful. But if somebody proposes an answer or a solution that is against God's mind, I say, no, I won't do that, because it's against God. If anybody proposes an answer that seems to be against my persuasions as a Christian, you will say, no, I wouldn't do that. I would not choose relief over obedience. I will not choose present relief over honoring the Lord and His Word. And so God is telling Habakkuk, Habakkuk is the proud persons who do that. And their ways will never be upright, because they will not wait for God's answer. They will not try to search the scriptures and see. They draw their own conclusions and follow it through also in life. And such ones will surely be, will not be upright before the Lord, because the very fact is, the just shall live by his faith. If somebody is a just person, one of the key marks of his life is that he lives by faith. What does that mean? He lives by the rule of the word. He lives only as God has said it. He does not understand everything, but he processes it as God has taught it. This is what we mean by a life of faith. And I hope I don't have to spend too much time on this. You know, charismatics have spoiled everything. What is faith? They tell you, don't you have faith? So you yourself fix your eyes upon something, okay? By next year I should be married. And then you simply say, don't you have faith? Claim it. This is faith. Of course, that is not faith. That is wishful thinking. That is a mere selfish interest. You don't call that faith. Of course, such a faith, even the devil has it. No, it's not faith. Faith is simply resting your hopes upon something God has said. So we say this, if God has not promised it, faith has no ground to rest there. If there's something God has promised, faith hangs upon it. If there seems to be no specific promise, faith hangs on the character of God. You see, it always has to do with God, not the thing I have in view. Faith doesn't start with the thing I have fixed my eye upon. Faith begins with God, either his promises or his person. In fact, we should mention his person first. And so, he that is a just person will live by faith, because he would say, even though I don't understand the difficulties, yet I will only accept that which God says about this or about that. You know, my dear friends, it comes to some of the favorite statements I often make. Yeah, the man of faith says, no opinion will appeal to me once the scriptures are spoken. No idea is appealing to me. I do not open my ears to listen to any other once the scriptures are made plain, because this is a life of faith. A life that says scripture is enough. Everything I need to know, everything I need to rest my life upon is here in the Word of God. My dear friends, do we believe that? What is our faith like? Are you striving by the grace of God to live by that principle? Friends, you know, you extend this in many, many ways. I think I have time to say, sometimes when you tell people that it is not the will of God that a child of God fixes his eyes upon an earthly ambition. And they say, hey, so then how would you advance? People ask that. It is not. Especially, you don't fix your eyes upon money. You don't fix your eyes upon wealth. The Bible tells us decidedly you will fall. you will pierce yourself through with many sorrows. You will hurt your faith. You cannot hold both. St. Spurgeon puts it this way: no one holds a full cup without a spill. You cannot fix your eyes upon wealth and still walk with the Lord. It's not possible. Okay? I cannot fix my eyes on promotion itself and still walk with God. Sorry. It will hinder me. And so what do I do? Well, friends, it's this. This is where faith helps again. I tell myself, Habakkuk will say it in the last chapter, I am content with my God. Whatever happens, I don't mind. My life doesn't depend upon nice circumstances. It doesn't. My life depends upon the Lord. If He smiles upon my life, that's life for me. If He bestows mercies upon me, that's life. I look to Him for everything. And what does it mean practically to look to Him? It's this. It's like what He says here. I say, if I have to pursue anything that divides my loyalty to the Lord, that divides my heart and makes me bring into a secondary place matters of my communion with God and my availability for the service of the Lord, I say, no, wait a minute, this cannot be the will of God. Why should I scrap these things for which I was saved for and really put something in its place? So then, how can a Christian advance? Because God may let some of His children advance to some of the high places in the world. Not every one of us. Those He allows, He will prepare for them. He knows how to really order their lives to make them get into that position. Well, how will He do it? He will cast their circumstances in such a way that they may get to that position without having to compromise anything. They will not have to compromise anything. And this is how they look to the Lord. They said, if it is the will of the Lord for me to get to that place, He will so order my circumstances. I will not have to shelve spiritual duties, stop my times of prayer, and cut down my times of studies, and really abandon it entirely, only because I want some ambitious thing in the world. A child of God says, no, yes, I must be disciplined, I must work hard towards something, but I must be so clear, and the devil is always able to confuse us. I must be so clear that I am not doing this because I think my well-being depends upon that. Friend, that's a betrayal of the Lord. If a Christian begins to feel my well-being depends upon that status, that's a betrayal. The Savior said, without me, you can't do anything. Only me. Upon me, your life depends upon. Not upon any circumstances. And so in that persuasion, the Christian watches to see how God orders his circumstances. Always patient, saying, if I have to take this move, and it means scrap all spiritual things, scrap all spiritual duties, then I say, no way. I must wait a while. I must wait in patience. If it is the will of the Lord, He will so order my circumstances. Friends, it doesn't mean that you are always seeking for the easier way. There will be times when you have to really stretch yourself to the very maximum to be able to carry out even your ordinary duties. And in the workplace, in life, in schooling, and things like that. Oh, but friends, this our faith runs through it. You have your eyes upon the Lord. And let me repeat that. You never feel that your well-being depended upon any circumstance. You are persuaded, my well-being depended upon the Lord. Anyway, Habakkuk said it in a better way. I'm sorry. When we come to that. So now, the Lord gives him the answer. Verse 5. There's some answers given him. Yea, also, because he transgresseth by wine, that's the Chaldeans, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied. but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. He's enumerating some of the sins of the Chaldeans, and he's talking about the fact they never satisfied with anything. They conquer and conquer. They are never satisfied. They won't enlarge and enlarge themselves. And God says, so you see, God is saying that, oh Habakkuk, I know the sins of the Chaldeans. I know all the foolish thing they're doing. And so what would happen to them then? God says this, I will punish them too. I will punish Judah by the Chaldeans, then I will also punish the Chaldeans also, because I'm the judge of all the earth. And so here he enumerates the sons of the Chaldeans, and he tells what he would do unto them. For example, when he mentions their person in verse 5, look at verse 8, what he would do unto them. Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the earth shall spoil thee. Because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land of the city, and all that dwell therein. So I will let other nations rise up against thee, and they would ruin you also. He mentions another sin, verse 9 to 11. Their covetousness, and he also mentions their sin of... Verse 12, another one here. Verse 12, let's pick that one and see how God will judge them also. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood, establisheth a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts that the people shall labor in the very fire, and the people shall weary themselves by very vanity? For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. The Lord is saying, I will prove myself to be Lord over all, so that all the nations will learn that I am the Lord. And with my knowledge of my power and of my sovereignty over the nations will be learnt by all of them. And so, for the earth, both Chaldea and all the nations in Judah shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God. Who God is, the God who is a judge, because he will surely punish the Chaldeans and bring them down. And let me come all the way down, my dear friends, to pick up something here in verse 18. What profiteth the graven image, the idolatry? The Chaldeans, and so the Lord spoke about the idolatry and the fact that they glorify them. And listen to what he says, what profiteth the graven image, that the maker thereof hath graven it, the molten image, and a teacher of lies, that the maker of his work trusteth therein to make dumb idols. You see, idolatry is a lie. The people would put their confidence in idols. This is what the Lord would do. Woe unto him that said to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is laid over with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in the midst of it. And so God said, woe unto them. And by huge contrast, look at verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Let no one quarrel with him. Let no one question his ways. If you don't understand, you know how he did with Job. After Job, Ephesus, his friends were the ones who stirred him up. And Job raised a number of questions. And then you remember that, if you read that, usually that's the part people love a lot. Because when the Lord appeared to Job, he said, Job, where are you? Stand up and I will ask you questions. It is as if God was going to give Job answers, because Job has been raising questions because of what their friends were saying. Job was saying, I don't think I'm a sinner. Not because I'm not a sinner, but I'm not sure I'm living in some secret sin. That is why this has come. And friends would say, no, otherwise this wouldn't have happened. So there must be some sin. So Job had to say several times, no, I'm not living in some secret sin. I have a question before God. If this is true, if what you're saying is true, then I have this question to God. And then when God appeared, he said, Job, where are you? And then... you know the questions God asked him. He said, Job, get up. I'll ask you questions. When I created the angels, where were you? When I made the seas and let Leviathan, I think he's talking about the sharks and the big creatures in them, and I gave them life. Surely you have an answer, Job. Give it to me. Where were you? And Job said, Lord, I put my hands upon my lips. I'm saying no more. I'm not going to question you anymore. And that's what this passage is saying. I will let Claudia put his hands upon their mouth and be so ashamed that they ever exalted themselves against God. My dear friends, this is how a man of faith lives. Sometimes you do not understand God's ways, but you stop your heart from quarreling with God or raising questions. I don't understand. My portion has been difficult. There are deep difficulties in my life, but I do not know. I trust the love of God. He had demonstrated that love in the Lord Jesus Christ when his own son came down and went to the cross of Calvary and bore the curse that I should have borne. That is an enough answer to prove his love. If I cannot understand anything else, let that silence me from ever thinking that he doesn't love me. And so, but the Lord is in his holy temple. In his temple, as in Jerusalem, but also in the heavens he means. The Lord dwells over the nations. And because he says, let all the earth, if it were Jerusalem alone, earth would be difficult. So it's both in Jerusalem, where his presence was particularly manifested for the Jews' sake, and then over the heavens. And let all the earth keep silence before him. Bow in reverent praise. When we cannot find the answer, we can at least adore and worship his wonderful wisdom. And so this is what the Lord tells Habakkuk. And then chapter 3, this is how Habakkuk responds. Now, he responds with first an intercession, a prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet, upon Shigionoth. Now, this is the way a music must be played with varying tunes. And then the last word there concerns stringed instrument, has to do with the instrument. So this has to do with the kind of tune they should use. And then the last verse will have to do with the kind of instrument they should use. So what he's saying here, he was going to give it to the people to make it a song. Because when it becomes a song, then it will be remembered always. It is not easily forgotten. And so he will put it forth as a song. And so, O Lord, I have heard thy speech and was afraid. I heard of your speech, of what you would do to the Chaldeans. And I'm afraid, because your ways are amazing to me. You will surely judge them. I thought that you were using a wicked nation to punish people who are better than themselves. But now I understand and I'm afraid. O Lord, revive thy work in the midst of the years. Know what it says? Because you see, when God said that you use the Chaldeans to punish the people of Judah, it meant that he would actually let the Chaldeans come and take them captive. He would take them away, as he did in the days of Zedekiah, the last king of Judah. But now he makes it to a prayer. Lord, revive thy work. Let there be a fresh spiritual work among your people, so they will not have to come under your judgment again. Renew, bring a hope. And this should be our prayer, friends. It fits Ghana so well, dear friends. Can't you see? And we raise questions, can't we? Don't we? May we also pray as Habakkuk did. Pray that the Lord will revive his work. O Lord, revive thy work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make known. In wrath, remember mercy. Even when you are angry with your people, look in mercy upon them and bring them back. Renew spiritual things in them. And then he was given a vision. He was reflecting over some of the works God had done in the past. This, the purpose of this is to strengthen his faith in the fact that God has power enough to answer his prayer. You remember, his prayer in verse 2 is, the Lord, bring them back and establish them and do a wonderful work among them. And God shows him the wonderful things he'd done in the past to convince him that he's able to do that. And so Habakkuk, and so that there, friends, my time is all going on. Just a few minutes now left. For me, but let me just pick out an aspect of the work done. God came from Teman, verse 3, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, they have that word, the selah. Selah is it's a musical term. It means to pause. And so it is a musical thing which is put there so there's a pause, because usually what is going to follow is going to describe some glorious attributes of God or His works. It's almost like if, wait, prepare your mind, don't just rush through what you're going to read further. So pause. And so the pause there is put there. Usually it's at the end of the verse, as you see that in the Psalms. But here, it's put in the middle, and God's glories are mentioned. What is Teman? Well, Teman is the southern part of Judah. You know, Teman is a place, Teman, very close to Paran. You know, Paran is that whole wilderness where Mount Sinai was. And so he's actually drawing our mind to when God revealed himself at Mount Sinai, when he called up Moses to the mountain, and then there was that wonderful display of God's power, so that everybody feared. And so that's the work in that southern part that he has. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Paran. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise, and his brightness was as the light, and had horns, power coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. You see, as there's a description of God's power, so that Habakkuk could be confident that God is able to subdue the Chaldeans and bring back Judah to their land again. That is the purpose of it. But let me go to, my time is almost up, friends. Let me go to verse 16, because it has a very beautiful description there, full of lessons. Verse 16, when I heard, my belly trembled, my lips quivered at the voice, rottenness entered into my bones, and I trembled in myself that I might rest in the day of trouble. That's a curious statement. Did you follow that? Don't miss that, because it's a very beautiful description. And I trembled in myself that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he cometh up unto the people, he will invade them with his troops. That's what it means. When I heard of what the great work God would do, how he will subdue, he will humble the people of Judah by Chaldea, and that he would also humble Chaldea also. When I heard of these wonderful works that God would do, I trembled. And he's now saying, it is good that I did so, because the trembling led him to God and to seek his answers from him. And by that answer, now his heart rests. Do you see? So it was good that he trembled. The opposite would have been indifference and coldness. And then what would happen is that when the trouble actually came, he would be so shattered. Now that he went to God and has gotten answers from God, if the troubles come, he already knows that God said it. God is simply fulfilling what he told me. You see, it will not really move him in a negative sense. So he trembled in himself that he might have rest in the day of trouble. When the trouble time comes and God visits Judah by the people of the Chaldea, he can rest in his heart and say, I know this is not the end. I know this is not the end. The Chaldeans that are punishing Judah will themselves will be punished. And I know that God will restore Judah. You see, he trembled because he took it seriously. Friends, you see, it has a very beautiful application, friends. When people take the things that are happening seriously, you know, there's a tendency, friends, my time is up, there's a tendency that our knowledge of the sovereignty of God almost make us people with our feelings. It shouldn't. And this is how it works. You know, because think of it. If I know that God is in charge of everything, and I see sin growing on every side and wickedness increasing, I can feel so indifferent and withdrawn and say, anyway, God understands. He is ruling over everything. He knows why he's permitting all this. In a very callous, heartless way, like that, you can just leave it. But you know, one of the things you learn about the sovereignty of God, you see that in Daniel. You remember, Daniel knew that after the 70th year, God was going to restore Judah. But we are told in the book of Daniel When that 70th year came, Daniel went pleading with God. Why? God would do it anyway. He promised it and Daniel knew it. It is the difference between somebody who merely knows God's ways mentally and somebody whose heart is actually in it. Heart in it in what sense? In the sense that he truly longs to see it. God will do it, but I long to see it because I want to be able to rejoice and see my God at work. My God triumphing powerfully and honoring his name. And that's what puts your heart in the matter, you see. And so Habakkuk surely would have known about the sovereignty of God and the power of God. But when he heard the answers God was giving him, he went to God with the questions. And when God gave him answer, he says now, I trembled in myself when I heard those things. I quivered, even my lips were shaking. But here am I. I now rest. Now first the trembling, and then the rest. See, Spurgeon says that this is how holy men have always worked with God. There's the first the fear of the Lord and of his ways, and then rest in their souls as they now rest upon his promises. It shows that they take God seriously, and they take his threatening seriously. They take his warning seriously. They're not calloused, but they can feel these things and long for them. Friends, I wish I could spend time on that to really apply, but my time is up, friends, and our time of closing is also out. But look at that closing. It's a message of faith. I'll just read that to you. And listen, this is Habakkuk. Now that God has made him understand that he is in charge, listen to him. Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall the fruit in the vines be in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the field shall yield no meat. The flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls. So there's total dryness, isn't it? Nothing at all. And he says, this verse 18, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. You see that let the circumstances be as it may. I do not look upon circumstances, he says. My life is upon God. Oh, friends, it's so liberating. If our faith will be so strengthened that we do not depend on our circumstances, we will praise surely for favorable circumstances, but we don't live as if they are changed, we will be changed also. Our God will not change. The God in whom we have put our trust does not change. And so let the circumstances change, but let our hopes remain firm in the Lord, and he will strengthen us. He mentions verse 19 that he will restore them and he will be their God and bless them. Oh, friends, I've taken some of your time. Forgive me, but we have to close this evening. May our faith be strengthened by these thoughts.